thanks again to both of you for your flexibility.
I'm going to put you through. I'm perfect. Gonna catch them through the board.
Looks here. Like I'm going to watch our sound wave blow up on here.
Yeah, let's see here.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on 2 seconds. I'm putting on headphones. This is so fancy. All right.
Can you hear them?
Can I hear you both?
Yeah.
Excellent. The last interview I did was not this fancy.
All right.
The first one I did was not this fancy. It was on just a Zoom audio thing, and so now we're
and
real.
You can
fancy.
Hang that phone up. You won't. You
okay.
Won't kill
him, so. Cool. So. All right.
I think you're rolling.
Great.
So let me double.
Thank you a million, Chad.
Let me listen for just 1 second here.
I'm hanging up this other phone that hopefully doesn't ruin everything. Okay. So can we start with just a brief intro? Danielle, if you'd like to go first, can you tell us a little bit about your background, maybe just schooling, jobs, interests in maybe, you know, a few minutes?
Okay. Sure. I am originally from Canada, and I did my Bachelor of Music at McGill University. I did a Bachelor of Education at the University of Toronto.
Okay.
And then I taught high school band for several years in the province of Manitoba, where I'm from.
Cool.
And
do you, sorry to interrupt, do you know Leah McGray?
Yeah.
Do you know Leah?
So I know of her.
Okay.
I feel like we've been, like, our circles haven't quite overlapped yet, but I know of her. I know
oh, cool.
who she is. And as her, another Canadian, you know, in the States.
And she's from, I think she had some similar background things as you. I didn't mean to interrupt and, like, assume that everyone in Canada knows everyone.
almost.
Sorry, you were saying you taught high school band.
Yeah, I taught high school band, and I did my master's in wind conducting at Penn State University.
Okay.
And my doctoral degree at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. I've been teaching here at Cal State University East Bay since the fall of 2013. So this is my sixth year here.
Excellent.
So that's kind of me in a nutshell. In terms of interest, do you mean like in terms of programming music? Or,
yeah, a little. Yeah, certainly.
I mean, I'm always interested in finding. I like finding Canadian music or music by Canadian composers as something that, as a Canadian, we always feel that, you know, because the United States is so close and. Such a large presence, we often feel like we have to champion, you know, Canadian composers just to kind of be heard.
Certainly.
And as, you know, as a different voice. And so for me, that's something that I'm always interested in finding, you know, and also, you know, female composers and minority composers are something that I, you know, kind of more recently been interested in championing. So
excellent. Well, that's perfect for what I hope we'll have a chance to talk about in a little while.
Great.
That's awesome. Lauren, yes. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself as well? Kind of the same outline?
Sure. I grew up in the DC suburbs in Northern Virginia and was fortunate enough to go to a high school with a very strong and reputable music program, played at Midwest, that sort of a program. So was bred into being interested in the band, I guess.
Sure.
And went to the University of Delaware for my bachelor's degree in music education and stayed for my master's degree in wind conducting and then taught high school in Southern Maryland and taught high school bands and all the things that go with it. And then also got my DMA at CCM.
Super.
Then I taught for 5 years at Central Connecticut State University as the director of bands there. And I'm in my second year now at the University of Delaware, my alma mater and my new home as my job.
Lovely.
We're in the director of concert bands and conduct the wind ensemble and teach conducting and wind literature.
That's great. Well, super thanks to both of you for being willing to do this. this is only my second interview, and it's still kind of evolving. So I'm just going to start with our questions that I had sent you as kind of an outline, and we'll just maybe jump around a little bit. One of the first questions that I posed to everyone, and you, the two of you can decide who'd like to jump in first, but was, do you think that band conductors from the earliest 20th century would recognize our ensembles today, and whether or not you think that's good or bad?
Well, I was thinking about this, and maybe, you know, where I teach is coloring my answer, but I think conductors from the early 20th century would not recognize bands today because of the diversity that we now see. I see this very strikingly every day where I teach, in that the Bay Area is one of the most diverse places in this country and perhaps on the whole continent. And we see students, you know, we see a healthy mix of female and male students, but also people coming from all kinds of ethnic and cultural backgrounds. And so, I mean, I think that's great because yeah. The more diverse we are, the more, the richer the experience is. But I think that certainly, you know, 100 years ago, bands did not look like this. And I think they would be pretty surprised to see, you know, the makeup of our bands today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd agree on the gender side of things. I don't live on I don't work on a campus that's as diverse as that particular area. But as far as the makeup of our ensembles, I think the gender shift to probably about equal, I would say, about half and half, would be pretty unrecognizable from the beginning of the century. I was also conceiving of this question in a different way as well. As far as the makeup of the ensembles, as far as instrumentation or music they're playing. So I would say, no, they may not recognize, well, they would recognize, but it may look quite different from how things were looking 100 years ago. As far as the flexibility in the ensemble and the, you know, the fact that players are rotating around and players are shifting and not everyone's playing on every piece and we're doing maybe more project-based typed experiences. So I don't think it's a bad thing, and I think it's a good thing, and I think it's different, so familiar maybe, but quite different than what was being seen 100 years ago.
Yeah, I love that you both thought about that in, you know, in multiple ways. I hadn't considered the just actually visual differences, like you were talking about, Janelle, and diversity, certainly coming from the Southwest.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how undiverse my undergraduate degree was because I had never been anywhere where I was a minority. In New Mexico, I'm of Hispanic, you know, heritage, and so everyone kind of looked like me. It didn't really surprise me until I moved to the Midwest and went to school in Indiana, and it was like, holy cow, there are people from everywhere here. I like the ideal. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I went to CCM where, you know, I think when you're there, you think it's a pretty diverse place. There are a lot of international students. A lot of my friends were international students. You know,
right.
We were international students from Canada.
Right.
And, you know, you kind of feel like, wow, there are, you know, this place is pretty diverse. And then I moved here. I realized that, you know, everywhere I had been was really not that diverse, you know, until I got here. And you know, I when I do clinics in schools here, I'm just amazed at how different it looks compared to what I grew up knowing, you know, what I experienced in high school and even in university. It's really incredible.
Right. And I like, Lauren, what you were saying about some of the music and the diversity. I think there's a lot of sort of like we're reclaiming some of our music that's for wins. You know, the Strauss Serenade, it's like, well, darn it, that's ours. Dvorak Serenade, that's ours. It doesn't have to just be played once every 20 years by some orchestra somewhere. We could play it all the time.
Right.
So.
Right.
Well, that's great. I'm looking forward to this part as well. Number two is talking about, I asked, how important is selecting meaningful repertoire? And maybe you can talk about not only about meaningful repertoire, what that means to you, but maybe meaningful repertoire for the diversity of your population. Maybe that's a factor that you both take into account.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's the only thing that really matters. It's
absolutely top of the priority list. And meaningful, I guess, can be interpreted in a bunch of ways, but my sort of main criterion is, do I feel something when I experience this piece, whatever that feeling may be, but does it move me in one way or another? And if it doesn't, then it just doesn't make the cut.
Right.
That's it. Because you have to live with it, you know, especially in an academic setting like this. It's not like, you know, two rehearsals and go. We're living with it for several weeks. And so that's the top priority for me. As far as, like, how it relates to my students' experience or maybe doesn't relate, that's something that I consider. I never seek out a piece, like, for its cultural niche or something like that. Like, I need something that's via this composer or via that composer. But I often think about, like, what is this experience going to mean for the students who are playing it? Is this, you know, outside of their experience? Is this in their experience? Is this within their experience, but a different kind of way of seeing that? Or, you know, I question that, but that's not how I find a repertoire. So once, you know, once I come across things, that's sort of one of the first questions, but it's not how I seek out a piece.
Certainly.
I'm with Lauren 100% on the idea that the repertoire is the most important thing, because it is the vehicle through which we teach all of the concepts that we want to teach. So so for me too, choosing repertoire is the, you know, maybe the hardest thing that I do, because it to me it often feels like a big puzzle that has to fit together, while at the same time the pieces I'm choosing have to they have to allow us the opportunity to create art and to express something that cannot be expressed in some other way. And I think also, maybe more importantly now, the music has to relate to students on some level. And I'm finding that, you know, teaching in a, you know, in a program, in a smaller music program than maybe the places where I went to school, the challenges that I face are, you know, are sometimes of instrumentation and of ability level. And so, you know, I can't necessarily program the latest, greatest work, you know, by whoever the hottest composer is, because I just can't for various reasons.
Certainly.
You know? But also the students that I see that I work with are not, say, necessarily the typical students that you would find, you know, in a big conservatory setting. And so, you know, I have to find ways to make this music relate to them on some level. So I could program, you know, all the old white dead guys, and that, you know.
You said it first, Mommy.
And some of that is great, and I do. Some
right.
of that I feel like I have to do, because it's, you know, whether we like it or not, it's part of the canon, and some of it is just really great music.
Right.
But I don't know that it is serving my students if I'm only looking at that slice of repertoire, you know?
Right.
So choosing repertoire is like, it's a really challenging aspect of what we do.
Yeah. You mentioned, it actually sort of segues in nicely to what we're going to ask on number three. Danielle, you mentioned the canon, and I said the question three was, how do you approach programming and conducting music outside of the canon? And we can get into the details of what we decide canon is in a little bit. But certainly it sounds like you are doing a little bit of repertoire that maybe doesn't fit the first question's model, you know, early 20th century canonic band music. Can you talk about maybe how you approach that music with your students? You talked about making it relevant to them specifically, but maybe do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my responsibility is to expose them to music that they don't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's our job. And I think more than ever, students who come
who come to us don't necessarily know, they don't have maybe the same training or the same background. They don't know, they're not as familiar with the canon of, you know, Western art music that maybe some of us had, you know, had some grasp on before we went to university. I find that my students don't always, they're not always familiar with that. So I feel that part of my job is to expose them to some of that, particularly in terms of wind music, and expose them to the great things that are out there. But because they don't know this canon, they don't really expect, you know, they're not sitting there going, you know what? We didn't play a whole suite this year. What does, you know, why aren't we? You know, like, they're not sitting there wondering that. They don't have that framework already. So for me, I feel it gives me the freedom to explore other avenues, you know, and other ways to teach the things that I want to teach, and that I want them to experience. So,
yeah.
And I think too, you know, I don't want to keep coming back to this, but you know, the where I teach is so highly focused on the issue of diversity and of inclusiveness and of, you know, promoting our differences that the students kind of expect that from us, you know, they really do expect it because that is what we see when we look at our classrooms. So, that is a huge part of what I live here.
Certainly. Lauren, I know that you've just come off a concert cycle and are probably getting ready for your next one. And if I remember seeing your program, there's certainly, you did Prague, Music for Prague, of course, which is a major monster staple in the band repertoire, but there were also some new things there as well. Can you talk about, do you approach the new works for winds, things that are non-canonic, so to speak, with your group any differently, or...
I think inherently there's a little bit of a difference because there's a history that comes with a piece that's established in the canon, and it's important for the students to understand that and sort of be aware of the living history of that piece and how it's been evolving or not and how other people have experienced and what it has come to mean in the repertoire. And there's a performance practice aspect to music that's established that doesn't come up so much in newer repertoire. We performed alongside that. We performed Steve Danu's Into the Silent Land, which is quite new. It was just premiered last year. And then also a piece written by an alum of Danielle's school, Robert Litton, called One for All that she had told me about. I think I don't approach the mechanics of rehearsing necessarily differently until or unless it comes to a performance practice issue. But as far as like the global conceptualization of the piece and the experience of sort of understanding where you fit into history and the history of our medium, that plays into a canonic work like Prague more so than it does, of course, a new piece. For that particular cycle, I did a whole lot more of bringing in sort of outside voices and thoughts, and we had various folks come in to either virtually or live to rehearse the group and share their anecdotes. And our mentor, Rod Winther from CCM, who was very close with Carell, you know, came in and spoke with them and, you know, gave some context for the man and the music and you know.
Certainly.
He would, that's not something that can really, that's not something that exists with something that's so new. But on the flip side, for the new piece, we work at it from the same angle, just without the history. So we're working with the composer and working with the conductor of the group that premiered it and, you know, getting that sort of experience under our belt and trying to understand the composer's process, I guess.
Sure.
But it's a different kind of a process when the person is alive and the piece is still getting life breathed into it, as opposed to a piece that everyone has their anecdotes and their stories and their, when I saw him rehearse this, he mentioned this on this beat. And
right.
So same, but totally different, I would say. Yeah. Completely differently.
Yeah. You both talked a little bit about it at the beginning. I think I don't remember who said it first, but you talked. I think it was Lauren said it first that you don't seek out music by thinking of a certain type of piece you need or anything like that. But question four is: have you performed any music by female composers? And is there music that you like? Anything that jumps out in your minds? I know both of you have two very different ensembles, but I'd love to hear if there's anything on your mind that you've played recently or are interested in playing soon.
Sure. Do you want to go first,
Danielle? Sure. I can throw out a couple of things here. We're working on Early Light by Carolyn. I think it's Bremer. I'm not sure if it's Bremer.
Bremer, yeah.
Bremer, okay. So she just... unfortunately just passed away
right
just recently, but so we are working on her piece right now, and we'll be performing it in a couple of weeks, and I really enjoy the piece. I think it's a great piece, and it has lots of like interesting challenges for a lot of different players, but at the same time it's very relatable. And then we also, I do an honor band on my campus in the fall every year. And so we just did that a couple of weeks ago. And one of the pieces I did with those students was Alex Shapiro's Tight Squeeze.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, a really neat piece with like a pre-recorded soundscape. And so that was a neat experience and like just a fun piece. It's a really fun piece. The students really enjoyed doing it. So those are some things that were kind of like, happening right now for us on our campus.
Cool. We're performing Early Light tonight. We have a concert tonight, and that piece is certainly, it's much easier on the page than it is to rehearse, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Lauren, do you want to talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, sure. So we're going to be doing a piece by Sally McCune, called High Water Rising, but she has a couple of pieces that I'm pretty curious about. I've not done her music yet, but I've been interested in it for a little while.
Caveat,
Caveat is on my list, and that's going to be in March for us, but we're getting going on that. We're actually going to be taking it on tour this summer, so excited to hopefully get her name out outside of this region of the country a little bit. I actually started a youth wind ensemble this year, and this is sort of one of those, hey, look at that, I have a bunch of female composers on this program.
Oh, yeah.
I was seeking out a particular piece that was this difficult or filled this aesthetic or whatever.
Right.
And so quite a few. So one of them is by a Canadian composer. Her name is Kate Nishimura. Woo! And she wrote this adorable, very lighthearted, joyful piece called Chasing Sunlight, and it won like the Canadian Band Association Award a year or two ago. I guess they have like a composition contest, and it's lovely and charming and great, and the students really enjoy it. And we're also playing a piece in there. We're also playing actually an Alex Shapiro piece, Lights Out, which the students, of course, find novel and different, and most of her young band works include some sort of pre-recorded soundscape.
Is Lights
like
Out
that.
The piece with like neon paper, or is that a different piece? Is that paper cut?
She wants the experience to be as creative and free as you can. So any sort of light experience. So idea is that the lights go out in the beginning, and it's supposed to be staged so that it seems like it's an accident and the band plays despite that. And so we have glow sticks that just came in the mail today and all sorts of fun stuff.
Fun.
it'll be a hit with the students, and it fills that that sort of niche kind of experience for them. And we're also doing a piece called Solace Dance by Nicole Puno, who I hadn't heard of, but came across the piece, and it's lovely and also sort of fit the bill for what we needed with those students, and hadn't heard of it, but now I'm pretty curious to see what else she's got. So there's quite a few sort of individual pieces there. And then recently we had a guest on our campus a couple weeks ago. We have a string quartet in residence, very fine string quartet. And we were fortunate enough to have Caroline Shaw on campus. She's backstage, but as we know, she won the Pulitzer, when she was like 30 or something, the youngest person I think ever to win.
Wow.
Anyway, and To my knowledge, doesn't have any large wind pieces, and she's mostly string and vocal music, but she's just genius to me, and I'm waiting for, or maybe I'll take the reins here, the opportunity to get her to, you know, get some interest in winds and see what she can write, but I just think she's fascinating and brilliant and
wow.
very kind and humble also. So as far as musicians and, you know, in and outside of our world, she's top on my list right now of people to watch. And I'm fortunate enough to work with a composition colleague who is female. Her name's Jennifer Barker. And she hasn't written for large wind ensemble yet, but she's in process on a piece right now, actually. She's Scottish, and Celtic music kind of makes its way into all of her compositions. And so her piece that she's working on is for wind ensemble and Celtic drummer. So that should be pretty interesting. She's a beautiful composer, and I'm, you know, slowly gonna make my way in to see what else we can get out of her, because she's just absolutely brilliant and beautiful composer. So,
great.
Those and yeah, I have, you know, I've over the years come across several other composers who I've played maybe one piece by theirs, and I'm curious to see what else they have. There's composer Jennifer Beller. Do you know her music?
No.
She's from Las Vegas, I believe, and maybe she lives there still. But she, I think, trained at Eastman, maybe. And actually, I think she trained also at maybe Cornell or somewhere else on the East Coast, where she studied with Sally McCune, which I didn't realize until recently.
Oh, wow.
And she writes a lot. She's sort of got eclectic taste, and she has written a couple works for a band, and I'm going to say almost all or all incorporate some influence of jazz or some sort of fusion sound. So I played a piece of hers actually when I was at Central Connecticut called Electric Vortex. It had like a jazz combo and wind ensemble, which is
oh,
pretty
cool.
And she has like a piece for, I think, like solo drum set maybe and winds. So pretty cool stuff. And she's really, really talented. So she's someone I'm always waiting to see what else she's got
cool.
going on.
That's really yeah. great. Danielle, I'm interested to come back to you for sort of as we look at this next question. The question for five is, what is your impression of students in your ensemble and their performance of this non-canonic repertoire? Do they see it as innovative or something else? You mentioned that because your students maybe have a little bit less shaping, some of the students you work with have a little bit less shaping of what, you know, a canon might be. And I think certainly everywhere, particularly at the undergraduate level, there's certainly the not uneducated, that sounds horrible, but, you know, they just haven't maybe experienced a ton of this canonic repertoire. I know I didn't when I was entering as an undergrad. How do you sort of approach that music? Do you feel like responsibility to sort of create this new music is like, you mentioned having an effect on them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a double-edged sword for certain, because I feel not only that responsibility to expose them to some of the canons, but
right.
also to showcase some of these, you know, these pieces that, you know, could become part of the canon, or in my opinion, you know, should become part of the canon, and maybe compositions that that kind of relate to our daily lives maybe a little bit more.
Certainly.
You know, I think it becomes something that they can relate to on maybe a deeper level and bring into their own lives and kind of, you know, allow it to connect to their own experience. We find that a lot of our students are first generation college students.
Oh, right.
And a lot of them are, you know, dreamers or, you know, are like first generation Americans. So for me, the challenge is, you know, to find things that, you know, that they can relate with, something that maybe represents their experience a little bit more. And to kind of find things that can, you know, find music that has the value, you know, that I can buy into as well, you know,
certainly.
that that we can all dig into it and create something, create a shared artistic experience from.
In some ways, almost creating, I mean, the music that you're playing with them is going to be their canon. I mean, in many ways, it sounds like they're coming into this and maybe not, you know, like you said, I mean, I can relate living in the Southwest. I in my high school band program that I taught in, probably at least 24 students at least who were certainly dreamers. And this was, gosh, I don't remember how many years ago. But certainly their knowledge of Western classical music was not, they didn't know it. And so everything to them was like, anytime we played a piece with any one of the bands, I always thought that same thing, like, this piece is going to be with them forever. It's like maybe the second or third concert they've ever played in a large ensemble experience. Like, how is that going to shape their musical expectation? And then we go back to the first question of, well, repertoire is everything. So, oh my God, I hope I picked good enough music.
Right. Yeah. Like I'm totally with you on that. And that's why I feel such pressure when I'm choosing repertoire, because, you know, I can't program Hammersmith as much as I'd love to. I can't program it here.
Right.
Maybe someday I will be able to, but right now I can't do that. So what am I going to do instead?
Right.
You know, what am I going to do that can achieve something like that, but not that, you know, like Music for Prague, I would love to do that piece, but I can't do that piece right now.
Right.
So, you know, what am I going to do that will have an equivalent experience? So it's just a mindset shift, really.
Right.
And it's, you know, and what makes it challenging is that it's not, my training has not necessarily been, my training has been really steeped in the canon. I really think that the experiences I've had, especially my graduate studies, I feel like I've really learned the canon well. I really
right. Well, the two of your two teacher common teacher literally wrote the book. I mean,
right,
Rod
exactly.
Literally wrote the book.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So you know. Not that this is a bad thing, but I don't think that my teachers ever really stressed this idea of, like, let's find some more diverse composers. Let's see if we can have a concert of all female composers or all minority composers. You know,
right.
Like, that wasn't really part of my graduate school experience. And, that's just a fact, you know,
yeah.
It's neither good nor bad. But it just means that I have to really be outside the box in terms of thinking about the music that I can, you know, that I can share with my students, because it's not, I can't use everything that I learned.
Right.
As, you know, and I can use some of it, but I can't rely solely on that.
Right. And Lauren, I'm sure you have this equal experience now that you're programming for this high school group, this honor band, which, you know, I found myself in Maine when we had the same sort of thing at our university, trying to pick repertoire that they wouldn't get a chance to play in their school band programs, regardless of size.
Right.
Trying to pick stuff that's strong, like hard enough that they feel challenged over the course of the semester, and then trying to pick stuff that's interesting for, you know, moms and dads and students, the, you know, your entire audience, because they're doing something extra above and beyond. You don't want to just do the same. So I can imagine you're experiencing some of this as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're serving multiple masters, so you want to, you know, every, like Danielle said, every program you put forward, you're essentially saying, this is what I believe to be valuable, or this is what I believe to be important music or worthwhile music. And, you know, if you don't feel that way about it, then you're not being honest, and that's not going to serve anyone well. And at the same time, there needs to be a variety factor or whatever, something that's different, as you say, from what they're getting in their daily meat and potatoes in their programs. And depending on the program, they're all coming from different programs. Depending on the program, that may be very different things. So maybe they're playing the whole suite, or maybe they've never heard of that. Or maybe they're the best player in their school, and they played some of this music, but it wasn't going to be the same kind of experience maybe that they'd play in this honor band, or, you know, there's all kinds of factors. And then there's the recruitment and practical matter of, it needs to be satisfying and to a degree entertaining. to the siblings and the parents that attend, because they're paying money to play in this program. And if we want the program to grow and them to go back and talk about it at their schools, then there has to be a level of satisfaction and excitement about it.
Right.
There are multiple masters that we serve, and that only complicates the matter as far as, you know, I have to believe in it, they have to believe in it, the parents have to believe in it, the band directors have to believe in it and believe that I'm supporting what they're doing in their programs and not taking away from or trying to be superior to. Or
right.
So
certainly. Yeah, that's excellent. This next question that I'm looking at, I almost reworded it, but in the first interview I didn't, because I don't know, we didn't, so I feel like I'm just gonna leave it the same. So the question for number 7 was, if you identify as a female minority composer, conductor, performer, have you felt any type of imposter syndrome? And before you answer, I want to just say that of anyone that I've talked to, I think we could have just changed that to, if you identify as a musician, have you ever felt any sort of imposter syndrome? Because I think we all wake up on days and think, can I really do this? Am I really capable of doing these things? But I wonder if you might talk about that a little bit in your own experiences, maybe at different jobs or different places, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction to that question was going to be exactly what you just said, which is it has little to nothing to do with my gender and everything to do with being a human.
A type A band director?
Exactly. Completely worthless, and I have nothing to offer my profession, and why am I doing this? Every single day, maybe not every day. But yeah, that's frequent. I mean, I haven't encountered that in specific relation to my gender all that often. I certainly have felt my gender from time to time as far as, the good old boys club not being as welcoming, or, you know, we're not represented in that club as much. But I have to say, in recent years, I think the tides are changing, and there are some fabulous band directors who happen to be women and happen to be minorities. I don't know, I think it's less and less, and it's being discussed more, and so, I don't know, I've not felt put out by anyone else necessarily. I occasionally feel it, like there's the occasional moment where one particular individual will make me feel like, oh, well, little girl, you know, just sit down.
Right.
But those moments are fewer and farther between these days. Even practical things like what it means to be a female and a mother attending a conference are being addressed now. So,
oh, right. Yeah, the CBDNA National Convention is going to looking at providing, like, yeah.
Like, yeah. So, you know, so but I've never been made to feel like an imposter by anyone else. Yeah. That's all put on by myself and has nothing to
right.
do with gender. So,
yeah. And, of course, there's the international edition, Danielle. I mean, like you said earlier, you're advocating for Canadian composers and stuff like this. I guess I could list any number of these quantifiers and also identify the international aspect of you here working in California in an incredibly diverse area compared to what it sounds like your growing up, your background may have been.
Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it, I'm not. I, you know, of course I'm international and, you know, I'm a proud holder of a green card, but I feel less international than, you know, many friends I've had because, you know, Canada is very similar to the United States.
Right.
In many ways. So, you know, so I can't culturally, I don't feel so different. You know, in general, but maybe I can share that I spent 14 years in the Canadian military, and I started as a musician, but quickly became a conductor and was a commissioned officer for most of the time that I served, and if you want to talk about imposter syndrome, that
wow.
right there was
wow.
something I lived on a daily basis, feeling, you know, very isolated and very alone in that I was young and female and an officer in a leadership position and did not see myself represented, you know, almost at all. You know, I was part of an infantry unit, and they, you know, my peers were older white men, you know, kind of like my dad's age. And so So that was a real struggle to kind of find my place and to prove myself constantly. You know, and even as a female conductor in the military, of course, musicians are a very accepting group of people, and the issues I had were never really with them, but, you know, oftentimes with my peers and my colleagues, you know. And so certainly not having role models in that area was challenging. And I agree with what Lauren is saying. I also didn't feel, I don't feel like I had very many role models in terms of just, you know, seeing successful female conductors and feel though that now things are changing, and I'm finding that people of our generation and, you know, people I know as, you know, as colleagues are, you know, things are changing now, and it's becoming more and more acceptable to, you know, be a female conductor with a family and to kind of, you know, find space to make all of that balance out and all of that. So I think certainly things are changing, and I'm excited to be part of that change and to, you know, to be a role model for younger, you know, educators and conductors.
Yeah. One of the things that I always thought that, you know, the University of Illinois, Linda Morehouse was there. I don't remember what year she came from LSU, but, you know, thinking of that as like sort of the first collegiate band program in the country, I've always thought that was pretty remarkable that they had a female on faculty so early on, and that not until, I just Googled it to make sure I wasn't lying, but 2014 was the first female commissioned officer in the Marine Band, the President's Own, in the United States. 2014, that was 4 years ago. Michelle,
right?
Yeah, Michelle Rakers was, I hope I'm saying her last name right, she was the first female conductor of the Marine Band. And when I saw them play the concert, my first thought was like, wait a minute, first ever? Like, ever?
Right.
It's kind of wild.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, for those who don't know, there's an agreement between Canada and the U.S. and military reservists who are going to school in the other country are allowed to serve with a local unit while they are a student. And so my husband and I took advantage of that when we were doing our doctoral degrees in Cincinnati, and we served with the Indiana National Guard Band based in Indianapolis. Yeah, for the 3 years that we're there. And, you know, we arrived and everybody was like,
who are you?
Who are you? And we've never seen a female officer, especially not, you know, in the band world. And, you know, and that was just kind of like, you know, it was just something that everybody was, you know, just had to deal with. And they were, I mean, it was fine. They were great. They're like fantastic people and such an amazing, welcoming band. But it certainly was a little bit of shock to them to see, you know, a female captain in the Army, just kind of here I am.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
I want to bring the conversation back to this. We talked a little bit about the canon earlier, and I want to just, the question I had on here was, how do we work to shift the canon towards repertoire that looks more diverse than it currently does without denying the performance of masterworks? I was going to toss it, maybe Lauren, you just came off a concert cycle with both canonic works and new things. How do you see a balance in your own programming, or how do you consider newer repertoire in some ways almost in the shadow of other pieces? When you program Into the Silent Land, how do you consider that piece knowing that there's, you know, a million other, like we said earlier, I think Danielle said it, old dead dudes music available for us, that survey after survey, Towner, you know, all these people that keep redoing the survey says otherwise we should play this other music?
Yeah, I mean, comes down again to the fundamental question. That piece has power and meaning and depth, and so it made the cut. And so I knew it would stand alongside the rest of that program, and it did. And in fact, it was the piece that got as much or more feedback from audience and parents and all of that. So I knew it would be that way. So it was worth including. And yeah, if you haven't done it, you should do it. So
it's on my list.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I program approximately 1 year at a time. I do the whole year at once. And then I keep, of course, as we all do, a running cumulative repertoire list. And, you know, I'm constantly, it's, as Danielle said, it's the, like, most time-consuming and obsessive part of the job. I'm constantly looking at that and I'm thinking, hold on a second, we can't go a whole year without doing a masterwork. You know,
right.
We have to rethink this. So, you know, occasionally I'll have these great ideas and I'll put together this program and then I realize there's an entire semester that's all new music or that's all, you know, whatever. And so then I need to go back to the drawing board because that's, you know, it's not a super healthy diet if a student is just in the ensemble for that semester because we rotate by semester.
Right.
So I just kind of try to look at it globally and keep track of that stuff. Like I literally keep tabs on it in a database and you know, when's the last time that a student played a symphony, a major symphony, you know. So if it's been a while, that needs to come up in rotation. And we have a loose system, but a new system that we're trying to use to track that sort of thing. And, you know, when's the last time that they worked with a living composer in the flesh and so on? Or did a piece that has some sort of multimedia outside of music involvement that, you know, because these sorts of things are not just novel anymore, right? Some of the previously novel techniques are now like staple skills that a student needs to go if they're going to go out and be an entrepreneurial musician in the 21st century and like make a living, then they need to have experience with diverse repertoire and they need to know, they need to speak that language. And so I can't just do one or the other because they need to be able to play the Strauss Serenade with as much comfort as they do insert new piece with interesting techniques here.
Right. Insert new piece.
not gonna pull one off the top of my head.
Right.
But you know, so I try and keep it I just try and keep it rotating and keep a balance, and you know, I'm always looking at how the program itself, of course, is crafted as we all do, and is there balance and, you know, diversity within the program itself. Although that being said, the program we're doing now is virtually all Hindemith because that's what we're doing. So so this is an exception to that. But you know, then in the next cycle it will be John Corleano and some other stuff. So
cool.
Yeah. So just, you know, keeping track of it I think is the way to do it. Like I said, I don't seek out something to fill a particular demographic niche.
Right.
But I do ask myself if it has been too long or if there is nothing represented, then I need to go back and look again.
Yeah. Danielle, how do you feel about sort of as the canon the canon is pretty unreflective, I'm sure, of what your student population looks like. And I think anyone working in most of California would agree that it probably doesn't look much like your students do. How does that, do you want to talk about that and maybe how you see the canon shifting or how your sort of creating this own canon for your students as you develop that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think you're exactly right. And I believe that the way to shift this canon is by doing exactly what we're doing. And that's to always be thinking about how can I be more inclusive in my programming? And, you know, do I have some sort of representation on each program of, you know, of some female composers or minority composers. And sometimes it's tough, you know, because I find that we've done a great job in the band world to develop maybe lower level pieces for younger groups that have, you know, that are, you know, more diverse or coming from composers that have more diversity. And certainly, you know, you can find examples of diversity at the higher levels as well, but I feel like we're lacking a little bit kind of in that middle, you know, the grade 4-5 stuff, the sort of that middle pack where,
sure,
you know, we don't want to do beginning band pieces, but we can't quite do those grade 6, you know,
right,
giant pieces. So it's kind of finding that happy medium in between where we can, you know, where it's, you know, approachable and doable for us. But I think by always keeping that in mind and programming carefully, I think that, you know, over time, we create that canon for ourselves. I think the other way that things will change is by encouraging the leaders in our profession, the ones who teach at the really big schools, the big conservatory schools, the ones who are, you know, the conductors that we all know, you know, even though we don't know them personally, we know of them, the ones who lead in the profession. I think it's important for them to be inclusive in their programming also, because if they start doing it and they start including these pieces on their, you know, top 100 list of best band pieces or whatever, you know, I think that's how things will become part of the canon. And I really believe that the canon should not be a static list of pieces that will never change. I think that's kind of short-sighted to think of it that way, because the pieces that we all know as part of the canon now, they weren't always part of the canon. As you know, there was a point in time where those pieces were new and had just been written, and somebody had to champion those works. Somebody had to say, "Hey, everyone, listen up. This is a great piece. You know, you should do it." And so I think there's room to kind of expand our boundaries a little bit and to be more inclusive. But I certainly think I think it will take a few years, but I think that we're heading in the right direction as more of us, as you see more diversity, in our profession, I think things will change over time.
Yeah.
I want to echo that. To say I think about that all the time. The canon didn't die in, 1980 or I don't know when the last year was, right? And I was just talking about that with a student the other day. Like, it can be overwhelming because we're just adding to it. You know, the Hindemith Symphony does not become less valuable because there are new works that are added. And so that can be overwhelming. But I think the biggest thing, you know, we have to open the door, right? So, you know, I've had conversations with Black friends whose sentiment universally is, we're there. We just haven't had access to these opportunities, right? There are fabulous composers of all sorts of diverse backgrounds, you know, culturally and geographically and musically and whatever. And it's sort of, we're in a privileged position to, as Danielle says, champion those people and to reach out and open the door to people that are right next door to us and doing great work. And, you know, we can use our privilege, as it were, to do that. And I think it's sort of a responsibility that we have so that, you know, because I think that trickles down. The whole profession has to change, right? We all recognize that this is an issue that, especially in certain pockets of the country, not the West Coast and not the Southwest, but like most of the rest of the country, maybe not Florida, but most of the rest of the country, they've all looked the same, right? And it's a real problem. It goes all the way down to the young grades in school. And, you know, until all of that changes, it's going to be tokenism, right?
Right.
Program works or whatever. But you have to take that step, right? You have to. So, for example, there's a composer I didn't mention earlier, Sean of Pebble. Do you know him?
No.
Anyway, he's terrific. He teaches at Wheaton College right now. But he has several great pieces, and actually, to Danielle's point, they're of all different difficulty levels, including like a grade one little piece that's really cute, and all the way up to pretty challenging music. Anyway, he's awesome, and he's made a name for himself because he got a great university job, and you know, now he's among colleagues who are programming his music, and now people are hearing of him. But I think that, you know, we can't wait for that to happen, right? I have to go and make an effort to do that, and then in so doing, students come to my concerts and they see that, and it, you know, it trickles down, and the fabric of our profession can change, but not until we make a first step. We can't wait for it to come to us.
I like what you said, Danielle, about people, you know, major institution conductors making and just deciding that a piece is important. And I was just, we're playing a piece tonight, this by Omar Thomas, of Our New Day Begun, and it was commissioned by 39 different schools, and it got some traction. And then 2 years ago, Jerry Junkin played it at UT, and Mike Hathcock, University of Michigan, played it that spring. And now I'm looking on Omar's website while we're here, and there's about 60 performances this fall. So, yeah. I mean, that's like one of those things where when they say the piece is important, and Omar is commissioned, he's writing a new piece actually for the Dallas Winds that will be premiered in the spring, I think, with the Dallas Winds concert. Now he's like a household name now. You know, it's like one of those things where when someone of that, like you said, major institution, these people we know, when they say this is great repertoire, lots of people listen. Not to say that our voices are less important, but just to say the impact that they may have is great.
And right. I think we all have that on the scale. So, like,
oh, right. You've statewide,
the smallest states, right? So, like, there are only a few colleges in the state. And when we do something, people, the band directors in the state, see it and they're like, oh, what's that, right? And if they've never heard of it, that makes an impact on our tiny little scale.
And both of you and both of you conduct honor bands of some sort with high school students. So, that's certainly. Finds its way, infiltrates the band rooms that they return back home to that, oh, hey, you know, I just did this piece with, you know, so-and-so that's really great. Band director right. checks out so-and-so composer and finds another piece at a different grade level, and then maybe that becomes part of their pieces that they're interested in.
Right.
Yeah, it's great.
Of Michigan. Yeah. Go ahead, Danielle.
No, go ahead.
Do you know the piece Amen?
Yeah, the Carlos Simon thing.
Yeah. That's another example of, like, I was corresponding with Mike Hathcock about something over email, and then he said, oh, check out this piece. And, you know, they had just premiered it, or, you know, I think he's a Michigan grad also.
Yeah.
Right? Anyway, and I trust what he says, right? So I knew it was at least worth looking into, and that's a composer that I didn't know prior to that day, you know, and it's case in point, you know, and it's made its way onto my list of, like, wow, that's amazing music.
I have two questions for you, and let's just do them one at a time. Can you both tell me what you think the profession may look like in 20 or 30 years? And that can be anything. Conductor diversity, ensemble, makeup, instrumentation, repertoire, whatever you might think.
I think that the profession will look significantly different. I think you will see a better balance of female conductors in, leading programs of all sizes. I think you will see more diversity, absolutely. But I also think that our student body will look different. I feel like that's something we're experiencing here in California. Particularly at my school, where we don't necessarily have the students that we had 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Certainly,
like we don't have the same kind of students that that were there, you know, when I went to school, like when I went to do my undergrad. Certainly, so I think the makeup of students is changing. The kind of students is changing. But also, I think that part of it is we have to change what we're doing as institutions to better reflect what's happening in our society, but also to provide a more relevant education to our students. I think we're starting to see some of that with large institutions like, you know, places like Harvard, where they just did away with, like, music theory or something like that. Like, yeah. they changed the curriculum. It's happening at USC where they're changing their entire undergrad to look different. So I think we're starting to see the beginning of that change. But as institutions, I think we're going to have to adapt and be flexible in order to remain relevant to our students today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I actually predict sort of a, not a divide, but that there will become two types of training institutions, I guess. Those that remain the sort of conservatory model of performance and traditional Western music and and all of that. And then those that go, I think it was USC that I was going to bring up, actually. They just, like, blew the whole thing up, right? And just, like, are completely reconceiving of how it goes. And sort of, I think there will be a lot of schools that follow that model and are teaching entrepreneurship and are teaching all different kinds of music to their students and helping them to be self-promoters and to, you know, make a living in the world that they live in now and not the world as it was when we got our degrees. So
yeah, certainly.
I think there will be, I predict, two types of models. So this one will remain, and then there will be another model that a lot of people follow. But I also think the ensemble itself, I think I sort of feel the same way about that, that there will be some who hold to the tradition and then some that become more flexible. I see the flexibility and sort of project-based approach taking over in a lot of programs, especially the larger institutions. I think the larger and better equipped you are, the easier it is, on the surface at least, to do that, because you can rotate players and you can, whatever, you have the depth in studios and that sort of thing. Although there's certainly an argument to be made in the smaller programs with fewer resources that maybe that is the way to go and maybe stop trying to fit a square peg into a round hole
and
large ensemble when you don't have bassoons and oboes and, you know, all that. So anyway, I kind of think there will be a split and there will be those who follow the traditional model and then those who are adapting and becoming much more project-based and creative and flexible and fluid.
Cool. Sorry, Danielle, were you going to jump in there?
I was just agreeing. I think she's
got
right.
It.
Yeah.
Lastly, I can't thank you both enough for your time for doing this for me. What kind of projects are you doing that you'd like to share with us that you'd like to get out to the world? Is there anything you're working on? You're both working with some high school groups, these honor band groups. What, anything else going on that you'd like to share with people?
I'm part of a commissioning consortium, that Courtney Snyder at University of Michigan is spearheading.
Okay.
And we're commissioning Valerie Coleman to write a piece.
Okay.
So
awesome.
I think that's really cool. Yeah. And that's, I think the piece will be ready sometime, in, I want to say 2019. So I'm not sure. I can't recall the exact date, but anyway, so that's kind of exciting. And I'm also working on some, I'm going to be presenting a session at the California All-State Conference in February with some other colleagues from around the state, where we're talking about the struggles and successes of being a female band director. And we've titled the session, Nevertheless, She Persisted, Struggles and Successes of Being a Female Band Director. Because I think, you know, I think we all have some shared experiences, and we didn't want it to kind of be just a session where it's we didn't want it to be just focused on the negative aspects, but really, you know, to talk about how we've found ways to be successful and to balance life and all of that, you know, and to kind of perhaps give hope to, you know, younger female band directors. And,
certainly.
And so on. So those are a couple of things that I'm involved with right now that kind of relate to what we're talking about today.
That's awesome. It's great.
I'm also a part of that Valerie Coleman Commission. I just looked it up to see consortium members will receive completed score and parts by July 2020. So it's the following year, I guess.
That's awesome. Is she at Miami? Is that what is she Florida? Where is this? I was going to Google it, but I didn't.
Where she works.
Why did
she's
I think?
Part of the Imanians, I thought.
Okay.
Yeah, she's a flutist. Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, so I'm excited about that. I mean, we've commissioned a work by a live white guy. Brett Dietz at LSU is writing a piece for us for Vibraphone and Wind Ensemble, which we're going to take on tour to Spain with us this June with our retiring percussion professor who's been here about 40 years. So that's not directly related to this topic, but we are excited
about
that.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So, and we're going to be doing, as I mentioned, John Corleano's Mr. Tambourine Man with one of our voice faculty in March. So that's going to be a big old spectacle of women with the soloists and the conductors and all that. It's, in fact, last year it was kind of funny. I had three graduate conductors last year, all of whom were women. And then in the spring semester, my colleague Heidi conducts the second band, the symphonic band. And so we did a shared concert, and then it occurred to us only after the fact that all five conductors on that concert had been women. That was
wow.
Really funny. Yeah, but it only occurred to us when someone pointed it out to us. One of our, like our media and marketing person in the department said, look at that, you know, five women conductors, that's amazing. And we said, oh yeah, how about that? which is, you know, sort of an interesting commentary in and of itself that we hadn't noticed that. You know,
right.
That was kind of, but yeah, so I actually am really excited about that Valerie Coleman project because I think and that will be really cool. So.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, this is excellent. I can't thank you enough both for your time. I'm looking forward to sort of putting these all together, and I'll certainly share more information with you. Lauren messaged me the other day about it, but our WKMS station, who's been more than helpful in helping me organize this recording process and all these things, we're hoping to do some writing, finishing that up, and then have these all cut, clipped, aired, and packaged almost as like a one big project by the early part of next year. So I'll certainly send you the script way before then so you could read it and fill that out. But if your public radio station in your area, if you have one at your university or even in your area that is interested in running some type of different programming, or you can sell a wind band programming thing, I'm happy to share the whole thing. It just kind of goes out as like a big link download. So I'll send it to you as soon as I have more information, certainly.
Well, thanks for doing this, Trey. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, well, yeah. Again, I'm grateful for both of your time. Thanks so much, and I look forward to talking to you soon. Good luck with all of your projects that you have going on.
Thanks, you too. Good luck tonight. Too.
Thanks.
Yeah, we'll thanks.
Thanks. All right, okay. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I didn't know how to hang up. I'm pretty sure they both hung up.
Yeah.
But I was like, I'm just going to go get and you before I touch it.
Yeah, and I think it released the call. Yeah.
Cool.
So
thank you for that. Holy cow.
Yeah. So is it fruitful?